time. That
if this is the past light cone of an observer in drawn in proper time, then as you go back along the light cone, you know, this distance is, of course, by definition, the proper time between the, say, the emission of a photon and receiving it here by the at the observer's location. And this distance is the conformal time. So as you go back further and further, the conformal time is becoming larger and larger compared to the proper time because the light cone goes out. And this is just the statement that if I converted to using conformal time as the coordinate, that the light cone would be at 45 degrees. The conformal time at every point along the past light cone is just equal to the co-moving distance that is displaced. It's worth emphasizing that the conformal time is actually a global coordinate on the FRW spacetime, that it's not just something that's constructed to parameterize this particular, you know, another way of saying it is that the trajectory of the light cone here is just x equals tau, which is a function of t. But tau is actually a global coordinate. There's one global tau that works for every light cone. Now at the end, last time, I left off with the question that if I was observing a standard ruler along my past light cone, and it had some physical size, the standard ruler had some physical size and some coordinate size, I left with the question of whether the observed angle on the sky would be this or this or this. Well, does anyone have a proposed answer to this question? Yes?
I think the one on the far left.
The one on the far left. Any other? Let's give that one vote. Would anyone else like to vote? This one would be correct in a special case, namely the case where the scale factor is independent of time. Maybe you had the special case in mind. The only one of these that's correct for a general expanding universe is this one. The coordinate size of the ruler divided by the speed of light times the conformal time. Here's one way to see that. Imagine that I take this picture. By the way, whenever I draw pictures, I'm always using co-moving coordinates, but I may or may not be using proper time or conformal time. So imagine that I took this picture, and imagine that I have a ring of light cones, and then I slice it at the time when the photon is emitted by the standard ruler, and just sort of draw what the picture would look like at that constant time snapshot. Then in co-moving coordinates, the ruler, all of these light cones sweep out a circle, and the ruler lives on that circle. And because I'm drawing the picture in co-moving coordinates, this distance in the picture, the size of the ruler, is delta x squared. And this distance, the radius of the circle, is delta tau. That's this distance here. That's one way of thinking about the conformal time. So if you're thinking about this constant time snapshot, and it's important here that this is some constant time snapshot taken in global coordinates, so that the trajectories of the light rays, you know, there's no funny curvature in the metric or anything to complicate the picture. The trajectories of the light rays are just going radially. Strictly, so, you know, when I draw the trajectories of the light rays here, I'm drawing everything sort of smashed down into the constant time slice. So that the angle that I would see in the sky is just this distance, the arc length divided by the radius of the sphere, delta tau, with if I want to put this, if I want to put the C in rather than assuming C equals 1, it would go here. I think the moral of the story is that, one, there are multiple definitions of notions of distance and time in an expanding universe. It can be confusing which one is correct, even for those of us that have been doing this for a while. If you're just thinking about geometry, if you're just thinking about like trajectories of light rays and the angles they make when they intersect with each other, then you usually get the right answer. It's worth thinking through, but you usually get the right answer if you use coordinate distances and conformal time. Those are the coordinates where all of the light cones are simple. They just look like 45 degree angles. That usually gives the right answer. And it makes sense to think about proper time if you're actually counting ticks on clocks, not just thinking about geometry. We do measure standard rulers in cosmology, but they're usually statistical standard rulers. We don't really have objects that span 10 megaparsecs on the sky that we observe at cosmological distances, but there are statistical distance indicators like the location of features and correlation functions that we can use as standard rulers. Here's sort of a fun consequence of this. Imagine that you take a standard ruler of fixed physical size, delta x physical. The statistical standard rulers that I was just referring to tend to have a size which is fixed in co-moving coordinates, not physical coordinates. But a real object would have a size that's fixed in physical coordinates. Let's imagine that you take the limit of observing it at a very high redshift. You take the limit where it's going further and further back along the light cone. What happens to delta theta? A basic fact here that I should tell you, even though this sort of ruins a homework problem, is that the total conformal age of the universe is a finite number. Conformal time, one way of saying it is that the in this picture is that the observable size of the universe is finite. When you integrate all the way back to the Big Bang, you don't get an asymptotic behavior, but it stops at some finite distance, and that's all you can ever observe. Another way of saying the same thing in conformal time is to say that there's still a Big Bang in conformal time. That if I integrate back, the scale factor goes to zero at some finite conformal age. So with that statement in mind, that the conformal age of the universe is finite, what would happen to delta theta what would be its asymptotic behavior? If I fix delta x physical, so I'm thinking of a standard ruler whose physical size is fixed, observe it at an early and earlier time on the past light cone. So let's write it as sending the scale factor to zero. What happens in this limit? How would the numerator be related to delta x physical? Yeah, exactly, right. So it's a factor of a to the minus 1. That's delta x physical. Now, as I take the limit of observing further and further back along the light cone, this denominator is approaching a finite number. Delta x physical is fixed. The a to the minus 1 is blowing up because a is going to 0. So this actually blows up. An object of fixed physical size, if you imagine taking an object of fixed physical size and putting it farther and farther away, then obviously it looks smaller and smaller at first. But then the expanding universe has the means that when it gets far enough away, it starts to look bigger and bigger. And eventually its apparent size goes to infinity. So even a microscopic object observed very shortly after the Big Bang will fill the entire sky. That is just because there's a finite patch of the universe that we could ever observe. And the scale factor relating physical lengths to the co-moving lengths in this picture is becoming arbitrarily small. So even a microscopic object can fill that entire observable universe if it's observed at a sufficiently early time. The redshift where this peaks, where the angle is at a minimum, is a redshift of around 2. Redshift 2 is sort of the most demagnified time at which we can view the universe. I'm not bringing this up for any particular reason, I just think it's fun. That's all I have to say about the FRW metric. I want to talk next about, so are there any questions before about this FRW review before we change topics? Okay. There's one thing I want to talk about, which I wanted to set like a schedule for tutorials and homeworks. I propose that we have every tutorial due 2 tutorials later, the morning 2 tutorials later, so that yesterday's tutorial would be due on Monday morning. Does that sound good with everyone, including Gazel? Okay. That way, because I like to do like a tutorial post-mortem in the lecture to take like 10 minutes or so to talk about the tutorial. Then the homeworks, I'll assign a homework maybe tomorrow, well, one per week, and that could be due maybe on Wednesday. Does that sound okay? Okay. All right. The next thing that I'm going to talk about is, so the expanding universe is like the background where cosmology happens, but what evolves on the expanding universe are random fields. And cosmology is largely the business of doing various calculations involving random fields. So I'm going to start by I'm going to take maybe a couple of days to talk really systematically and generally about random fields and show you a lot of calculational tricks. I'm gonna start by just showing some pictures. I was briefed on the button pressing. I have to go down here and press some buttons. I just wanted to show some pictures first because I think it's useful, and then we'll raise the screen and talk through how to formalize the concepts in the pictures. So before I talk about random fields, I just want to talk about ordinary random variables in statistics. Here's a histogram of a made-up random variable x. When I say I generate a random x, I'm generating a number between -1 and 1 with this distribution. Here's what happens if I take 2 independent x's from that distribution and average them together, call the result y2, I get something different. It's now, in the original distribution, it was most likely to get something near the edges, but when you average them together, that becomes unlikely, and the most likely value is to get something near 0. if I keep doing this, here's the average of 5 x's, 20 x's, 100 x's, and so on. Then, the main thing that's happening here is that there's sort of a regression to the mean where the distribution is getting narrower and narrower. And if I scale that out to get a better look at the shape of the distribution by instead of dividing by n, I'll divide by the square root of n. Then what happens is that these distributions are approaching some limit. What's happening here is that you're seeing the central limit theorem happen. The central limit theorem says that if a random variable z is the sum of many independent terms, the exact assumption needed for the central limit theorem to apply is that the x's are independent and identically distributed. Then the result has some universal shape, which is the Gaussian distribution. You can see these are real Monte Carlo simulations I did on the computer. And if I overplot e to the minus x squared, it fits perfectly. All right. Now, here's the 2D version. Now, when I talk about multivariate random variables, I just mean that I have a random variable with two components in this case. Here's a made-up PDF. Probability distribution function. If I draw a random x, I'm now talking about something with a vector with two components. Here is this probability distribution. So, it's most likely to be on this edge. I didn't put any variation with the angle here, except for I put these cutoffs and angle. The point really is that the actual details of this distribution aren't important once I start averaging. Now I'm going to draw multiple x's and average them in the vector sense. One way of thinking about this would be a random walk. I draw a vector with this distribution, and then I add it to another vector drawn to the same distribution and so on to get a random walk. Let's look at the probability distribution for where that random walk ends up. So here's the result with two x's, five, and so on. You can see that it Gaussianizes pretty fast. So this is a Gaussian probability distribution in two variables. And the details of the original probability distribution are washed out. And the only thing that matters are the width of the distribution in the two in the x and y directions. That's setting the overall size of the ellipse. And the fact that there was some sort of correlation that's between the x and y components in the original PDF, that's setting the tilt. I was sort of surprised. I had never done this exercise before. I was sort of surprised by how quickly random walks Gaussianize. Even with two steps, it's already starting to look sort of Gaussian. With five steps, it's hard to tell the difference by eye. All right. So, of course, there's an n component. We've talked about random variables. Which are scalars and random variables with two components. Of course, the n component case is an obvious generalization where I talk about a random variable that consists of n numbers. To have a cosmological example in mind, you could think about the CMB temperature is at n different locations on the sky. So at a particular point, the CMB temperature might be a little hotter or colder than average. Those n numbers, the CMB temperatures at n fixed sky locations would have some joint probability distribution at n dimensions that we're going to talk about. A random field is what you get if you take the limit of very large n, so that you're talking about the CMB temperature at every point on the sky at once. So now the random variable is a function that can depend on arguments, in this case, a sky location. Sometimes that's useful to think about a function as an infinite dimensional vector, a vector in an infinite dimensional space, rather than an n-tuple. When you think about random fields, you imagine that this is, you can't draw the PDF anymore because it's infinite dimensional. But if you draw a random realization from the PDF, then you can sort of get an understanding of the statistics of a random field. Here's a random field, which is so-called white noise. White noise just means these are in 1D, so you could think of them as time streams. The term white noise just means a random process in which every sample, every time value in a time stream, or every pixel in a 2D case is independent of every other. This is a random walk, meaning that I simulated it by taking the cumulative sum of a bunch of independent random steps. This is what you would call red noise, because it has more power on long time scales than white noise. When I was prepping this lecture, I found a Wikipedia article on colored noise that had this long classification of pink noise and purple noise, and depending on the exponents of the power spectrum of the walk. And of course, here's the random field in 2D that we're going to talk about a lot, the cosmic microwave background. That's the end of the slideshow for now, but the slides are going to come back after I do a little math. So a random variable x, I'm just talking about a scalar random variable. I'm going to go with the physicist definition of a random variable. Which is anything with a probability distribution. Distribution P of X. So to be formal about what this actually means, the PDF is defined by a probability distribution function P of X. The PDF is defined by the statement that the probability that the random variable X is in a certain range is just the integral of the PDF over that range. In particular, the integral of the PDF from minus infinity to infinity has to be 1. So the PDF is like differential probability per unit x. The physicist's definition of an expectation value f of x. So f here could be any function of the random variable x. It's just the average over repeated observations. And these are calculated by just doing an integral, which is weighted by the PDF. So the expectation value would be I integrate over every value of x that can occur, weighted by the probability of getting that x, times the quantity that I'm averaging. And some examples that come up all the time are, first off, the mean, which is often denoted x bar, is just the expectation value of x itself. The bar is just a notational synonym for the expectation value. And the variance, I write it as var x, is a measure of the size of fluctuations around the mean. So it's defined to be the expectation value of x minus x bar squared. If you expand that out, then that's also equal to the expectation value of x squared minus the expectation value of x squared. the square root of this number, this number is the expectation value of the square of fluctuations around the mean. So the square root of the variance is giving you a notion of the width of the probability distribution function. And sometimes the square root, just as a bit of terminology, sometimes the square root of the variance is called the RMS for root mean square. Now, a random variable is a Gaussian if its PDF has a special form. For some choice of x bar and sigma squared. I'm not really going to motivate this form of the PDF, but the most natural way to motivate it would be to prove the central limit theorem, which just says that if I start with an arbitrary PDF, there's some technical conditions that are, like, you can't have, that are needed for the central limit theorem to apply. There are some weird counterexamples, but barring things that almost never come up in physics, the central limit theorem says that if I start with an arbitrary PDF and I average together many identically distributed independent samples from that PDF, that I end up with something that is Gaussian. So the memory of the original PDF is washed out, except for the mean and variance. Some expectation values. So this is just some function of x, and you can do integrals and calculate expectation values. Let me write out a few just for fun. The expectation value of x itself is this parameter x bar, as the notation suggests. The expectation value of x squared is x bar squared plus sigma squared. Or equivalently, the variance is sigma squared. So the parameters here are the mean and the variance. Here's another one which I'll have you do in homework. The expectation value of x to the fourth. Gaussian random variables are everywhere in cosmology. For example, if you just download a CMB map, like the WMAP CMB maps, they give you a measured CMB temperature at every pixel in the sky. And if you were to just histogram those temperatures, you would find a beautiful Gaussian distribution. There's some statistical noise, but even in the presence of that statistical noise, you can say that the Gaussian PDF is reproduced by the CMB temperatures that we observe on our sky to an accuracy of about 1 part in 10 to the 3. A very strong statement. Now, in view of the central limit theorem, you might interpret... So the point I want to make here is that the Gaussian distribution is just sort of staring us in the face in cosmology. Now, generally when Gaussian statistics arise in nature, they arise because of the central limit theorem. So you might interpret this as some sort of clue that the initial fluctuations in our universe that we see in the CMB are built up by some sort of random walk-like process, that they are somehow the sum of many independent, identically distributed terms. Something that I find really physically interesting is that these Gaussian fluctuations are generated, if our ideas about the early universe are correct, if inflation or something similar is the origin of fluctuations, these Gaussian fluctuations arise by a completely different physical mechanism. They're not the sum of a bunch of independent contributions. They're just generated coherently by one quantum mechanical process. And the reason that you end up with a Gaussian PDF is quantum mechanical, and it comes back to the fact that in the harmonic oscillator in Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics, the ground state wave function psi zero is a Gaussian. It just has the functional form e to the minus x squared. And it's kind of a coincidence, I guess, that the ground state wave function in Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics has the same functional form as the Gaussian PDF that we get in the central limit theorem. That's very physically interesting. OK, I got a little sidetracked. I want to emphasize that the mean and the variance are defined for any random variable. If the probability distribution is Gaussian, then they determine the entire probability distribution. So they're all you need to know. These two numbers, the mean and the variance, are all you need to know. And other expectation values, like the expectation value of x to the fourth, can be determined from them. Okay. Now let's talk about probability distributions in n variables. So a multivariate random variable. I'm going a little slow in building up to a random field by going through random variables with one component, n components, and so on. But I think it's useful not to jump too much in abstraction at once. So a multivariate random variable is just a vector with n components. And the PDF is now a function of n variables. If I integrate it over all the variables, should get one. An expectation value is just calculated by integrating p of x times f of x, but now an n-dimensional integral. The Gaussian PDF, the mean, I'm just writing down the generalizations from the single variable case, which are kind of straightforward. The mean is now a vector. The variance generalizes to something called the covariance matrix. So I write it as like this. And it's defined, actually, let me write it as Cij. So it's defined as before the variance measured fluctuations around the mean, when I square x minus x bar, now there are two factors in that square, and I can put an index on either one. So I have two indices, and I get a matrix. And this is also by a little one-line calculation equal to this. The mean and the covariance are defined for the mean and covariance matrix are defined for any probability distribution in n variables. But there is a special distribution, the multivariate Gaussian, where they determine the entire PDF. And the multivariate Gaussian is this. The multivariate PDF is Gaussian. It's Gaussian. If it's PDF, it is. One thing I decided to skip is the calculating the integral to show that this PDF is correctly normalized. the factor of sigma squared in the single variable case becomes the determinant of the covariance matrix in the n variable case. And the factor of 1 over sigma squared here becomes the inverse covariance matrix. OK. So this, for some vector xi bar and matrix Cij. OK, so as suggested by the notation, so this is a function of n variables, and you can do various integrals. So some expectation values which come up. So as suggested by the notation, the 1-point and 2-point functions are given by these expressions. And the second expression is equivalent to saying that the covariance matrix is Cij, as suggested by the notation. OK, so as in the one variable case, there's a mean and covariance matrix that are always defined. And there's a Gaussian PDF which is determined completely once those parameters are specified. You remember from the slides that in the two-dimensional example, the PDF looked like a tilted ellipse. You need three numbers to specify a tilted ellipse, two widths and a tilt. And those are the three elements of a symmetric 2x2 matrix. Oh, I didn't say that the covariance matrix is always symmetric, but of course the definition is here symmetric in Inj. And in n variables, there'd be n times n plus 1 over 2 components of this matrix that describe n widths and n times n minus 1 over 2 tilts. You can also see that the level contours here are ellipses because for determining the level contours, I can forget about the exp, and what I have inside the exp is quadratic, so the level contours of that function are ellipses. Because the PDF is fully specified, you can calculate any expectation value you want. Here's a big messy one that I calculated before class, and I'll write it down first and then explain why I'm bringing it up. So if you calculate the general 4-point correlation, so the expectation value of 4 x's, for this general PDF, I have to erase this, right? Then you get the following kind of ugly looking expression. You get this term with the product of 4 x bars. You get some terms with 2 x bars and 1 c, like this. And there are 5 more terms here which are related by permutation symmetry of the indices. And then you get some terms involving 2 c's. And there are 2 more terms. Well, I'll just write them out since there are only 2 of them. There's this and this. There's a way of doing this expectation value without doing integral, and that is to use what's called Wick's. That is to use Wick's theorem. Now, Wick's theorem says informally. I actually don't know a very good way of writing down a formal specification of Wick's theorem. I haven't really thought about it. But informally, what it says is that an expectation value involving products of Gaussian random variables can be done by summing over contractions. So the way that I actually did this calculation is that I took the product xi, xj, xk, xl. Now, you've seen Wick's theorem in QFT, where it's presented as a statement about correlation functions in a free quantum field theory. A quantum field theory is just a Gaussian PDF in a situation where, in a path integral, where instead of having n variables, I have all the degrees of freedom of a field. The integrand is e to the minus s, where s is a quadratic action. So it has the same form here, where I have an x and then something quadratic inside the x. So it's really the same theorem in both contexts, and Wick's theorem comes up in statistics in addition to field theory. So what I do to calculate this expectation value is I sum over all the contractions. So there's a contraction that looks all ways of pairing the variables, pairing the x's. So there's a contraction that looks like this. That's this. There's a contraction that looks like this, which gives you CIK, CGL. Each contraction gives you one power of the covariance matrix. There's a contraction that looks like this. Now, in quantum field theory, you don't usually have these x bars. Usually, you're considering a situation where the mean of the fluctuations is zero. So the way the Wick's theorem works, if you have a non-zero mean, is that you're allowed to consider contractions where not every x is fully contracted. I'm allowed to write down a term where I contract xi with xj, and the xk and the xl are uncontracted. And what you do for that term is the contracted guy gives you cij as usual, and uncontracted x's just give you a factor of the mean. And there are five more terms like this that I won't write out. And finally, there's a term where nobody's contracted, and that's the term with four x bars. So Wick's theorem is almost always how we do the calculations in practice. We rarely go back to this closed form expression for the PDF. In fact, an alternate perfectly valid definition of a Gaussian PDF in any number of variables or for a random field is simply the statement that all of the higher point expectation values, you allow an arbitrary covariance and a mean if you want to have a non-zero mean. And then you make the rule that all of the higher expectation values are determined from the mean and covariance by use of Wick's theorem. That's an equivalent way of defining a Gaussian random variable. So in cosmology, all of our random variables generally have mean zero. If they don't have mean zero, we make them mean zero by construction. For example, the CMB temperature has a non-zero mean of 2.726 Kelvin. That's the average CMB temperature observed in all pixels on the sky. But when we compute correlation functions and things, we just always compute correlation functions of delta t, which is defined by subtracting the mean. So in the rest of the class, I'll generally assume that means are zero, but I wanted to keep them in for a few blackboards. Assume mean zero from now on. All right. So here's a really useful statement. Linear combinations of Gaussians are Gaussian. So to state this in a totally general way, suppose xi is Gaussian, an n-dimensional Gaussian random variable with covariance Cij. Let's define a new multivariate random variable by just taking some matrix and applying it to the x's. So this might have n, this might be a vector of length n, this might be a vector of length m, and this could be an m by n matrix. In general, so without assuming Gaussianness, I should put an x here. Hilbert's matrix Cij x. So without assuming Gaussianness, one thing that's easy to show is that the covariance matrix of Y is always given by the way that I defined it, A times Cx times A transpose. This is easy to show just by writing out. The let me just assume mean zero for simplicity. Then let me make the C A B. C A B, assuming mean zero for simplicity, would just be the expectation value of two y's. Each of those y's is defined to be a linear combination of some x's. I can bring the a's outside because they're just assumed to be fixed constants, not random variables, and evaluate the expectation value of the two x's as Cijx. And then if I just write this in matrix notation, I see that what I have is this. So any linear operation applied to a set of Gaussian random variables gives new Gaussian random numbers. For example, if I have a multivariate Gaussian and I just take one of the components and throw the others away, that's a Gaussian random variable because that's the special case where this is a 1 by n matrix. As another example, I can rotate Gaussian random variables around to some basis that's most more convenient. I just have to keep track of this linear algebra rule by which I rotate the covariance matrix consistently. So here's a fun example. Let's say that now there are math libraries that will randomly simulate a multivariate Gaussian for you. You specify a covariance matrix, and it will draw a bunch of random samples from the multivariate PDF. But just for fun, imagine that you didn't have that, but you knew how to sample the n equals 1 case. So if I have as a building block a routine that can randomly generate a 1D Gaussian, how would I generate a 2D Gaussian with some non-trivial tilt? One possible answer to this question is that you just apply the rotation matrix that makes this that removes the tilt. And then I just have two independent Gaussians. You could see, if you want to prove that, you might notice that if there were no off-diagonal term here in the covariance matrix, then the 2D Gaussian PDF would just factor as the product of two 1D Gaussian PDFs. So it's easy to generate a random sample from this PDF. I just generate the x and y components independently from each other, and then I just rotate back. What would the n variable analogy be if I had an n by n covariance matrix? And let's imagine that you weren't allowed to use a canned function that generates a random sample from the corresponding multivariate Gaussian, but you're allowed to use a function that generates a 1D Gaussian. Does anyone have a proposal for how you might generate a random sample from this n by n matrix? What would be the linear algebra operation, the matrix operation, that is the n-dimensional analog of rotating this ellipse.
Okay,
we
don't
have
SON matrix.
Sorry?
Control data with an SON matrix.
I think that's, yeah. So you're saying diagonalize the matrix. So for any symmetric matrix, it's a theorem in linear algebra that there's some rotation, some change of basis, which converts the matrix to a diagonal form with the eigenvalues of the matrix on the diagonal. And then it, in this basis, where the covariance is diagonal, the multivariate Gaussian PDF just looks like an independent Gaussian in each component. So the Gaussian-ness of a random variable doesn't depend on the basis in which you represent it. It might be convenient, not just for simulation, but for other purposes, to go to the basis where the matrix is diagonal and the different components of the random variable are independent of each other. Okay. So that's all I have to say about N. Multivariate random variables with N components. Now let's talk about Gaussian random fields. So this is a step up in abstraction, in which we imagine that I like as the motivating example. Imagine that you take a Gaussian random variable Ti, where corresponding to the CMB temperature at n sky locations. And then imagine taking the limit where you have many components in this vector and you fill out every sky location. Then this Gaussian random variable in that continuum limit becomes a function in this 2D example of two angles on the sky. So generally speaking, Gaussian random variables, or another example might be a time series, where imagine that you discretely sample some time series, and then you take the limit where the discrete samples get closer and closer together, then this would become a function of one variable. So in general, random fields, you know, are statistical concepts which are a step up in abstraction, where you replace the index of your vectors by one or more functional arguments, one or more continuous variables. So for example, if I have a, let's think about how the covariance might be defined. If I have a 1D random field, X of T, an example might be, in the slides I had the white noise example and then the random walk. Those are examples of 1D Gaussian random fields. Then the covariance matrix so if I don't make any assumptions at all about the statistics, then this would be just a function of the two variables T and T prime. And that covariance function is the random field analog of the covariance matrix Cij. Every index, every discrete index became a continuous argument. Usually when we talk about random fields, there's some assumption of symmetry. So unless otherwise specified, a 1D random field, we usually assume that it is time translation invariant. So that if that assumption is made, then the covariance can only depend on the difference between the times. So if there's nothing breaking the time translation symmetry and distinguishing a special time. Then this is how we would represent the covariance. This function is called the correlation function. And it tells you the level of, just as in general, the off-diagonal component of a covariance matrix would tell you how two components are correlated. This function is telling you how much correlation there is between two time samples taken at a given time separation. And correlation functions are everywhere. So this is a 3D example, but you know, just to give an example, there's a velocity correlation function in our universe that says that so we measure a velocity here on Earth relative to the CMB frame of of roughly 10 to the minus 3 C in some direction. And if an observer in the Andromeda galaxy were to measure the same velocity, were to make the same measurement, they would find a result which is highly correlated with it. It might be 1.1 times 10 to the minus 3 C. But if an observer which is 100 megaparsecs away makes the measurement, it'll essentially be independent. There's no correlation in direction or size. So there's a characteristic velocity correlation function that depends on separation. Just to give you some sense for what that looks like. Starts out high. It starts out 100% correlated and it falls off. And the typical correlation length is something like 40 megaparsecs. And this number, I'm just defining it roughly. You might as well take it to be 30 or 50 megaparsecs. Sometimes, just for fun, I'll tell you where it comes from. This is sometimes called the scale of matter radiation equality. And it is the co-moving size of the co-moving Hubble length, 1 over h, expressed in co-moving coordinates, evaluated at the time in the universe's history when the density of matter was equal to the density of radiation. That's just a fundamental scale in cosmology, 40 megaparsecs. As another example, if I take a place in the universe where the density is very high, like the center of a big galaxy cluster, then nearby parts of the universe will also be a little bit denser than average. But that's a statement that has a correlation length. If I go far enough away, it isn't true anymore, and it's the same scale. That's a very fundamental scale in cosmology. I've told you how to calculate it. This is calculating the scale is a straightforward calculation in the FRW metric. I didn't explain why it imprints itself in correlation functions yet, but hopefully we'll get to that. Okay, that was a little digression from just talking about correlation functions in general. We're out of time for today, so we'll pick up tomorrow by talking more about random variables, covariance matrices, and random fields.